of miles. So with that number of miles, your scatter would have that characteristic I described.
What's your analog TV stations on channel 2?
Yeah, give us some words on that, Eric. Where's the nearest channel 2 analog? Roughly how many of them are there in the United States? You being a broadcast, we keep your ear pretty close to the ground on that one. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, they have low power transmitters, usually like 100 watts, 200 watts, some of them are 500 or 600 watts, but that's it. There's a channel 2 digital in the city, but there's also an analog 17, I think it is. The ones that are left claim hardship because the transition time occurred this past spring. Everybody's supposed to be digital.
The program I was listening to had Spanish content in the on the sound channel. It wasn't, wasn't English speaking.
Yeah, that could still be domestic. Of the low-power analog channel 2 television transmitters in the United States and or the Caribbean, make a guess, Eric. How many are in operation, and roughly how many miles from us is the nearest one? KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
No, I could look it up, but right now I'm being lazy. I suspect that there's probably less than a dozen throughout the United States. Canada and Mexico, Mexico, I think, not Canada. They may still have a few. And there's also, there's no more low band. There used to be low band out of England, out of the BBC, but that was 405 line. The 405 line went away, I think, went away about 15 years ago, or 10 years ago. They were actually on, their band started where, I think their first channel in their low VHF was started at 49 and went up from there.
What about Cuba? Cuba is one of them, but here's my next question, Eric. With what you know about the current FCC rules, if I'm a low-power station claiming poverty, are there FCC rules that would allow me to continue for the time being transmitting analog, low-power, channel 2, over-the-air broadcast television? Are there FCC rules allowing that domestically right now, to your knowledge? KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
The FCC does everything on a case-by-case basis, so... Yeah, they make exceptions at times. They do really stupid things at times. I'll give you an example. At Glen Oaks, a company moved a transmitter from, a low-power TV transmitter, from somewhere up in Connecticut down to Glen Oaks, and the FCC licensed it. And they licensed it on channel 15. And it took about, when they went on the air, it took about 2 weeks for every police department and fire department in a 300-mile radius to start complaining. So that shows you how efficient they are in terms of one hand watching what the other one does. K2RIW, K2J.
The channel 2, the channel 15 transmitter, it's 6 megacycles of allocated bandwidth. Are those frequencies directly on the frequencies of those other services? I think the answer is going to be yes. That's quite a goof. How long did that condition persist before it got yanked off the air? Over to you, Eric.
I think they shut it down. It was like less than a week later. The public service band goes up to 512, my friend. And channel 21 is 515. That's the center of it.
Is that a conflict? Just a little bit. Wow. So you're saying they gave authorization for that. Out of curiosity, what's your guess as to how many watts output that transmitter was emitting, Eric? Go ahead.
No, that was an Xterra. That's a nice transmitter. I think it's probably about 600 or 700 watts, They're typical. Because of the height and the gain, they probably had a pretty punchy EIP.
Okay, that many watts, but it's somewhat smeared over a 4 megacycle or so bandwidth for the video. And as such, the number of watts per 15 KC that's interfering with each one of those services is quite a bit lower, and it depends on what the picture being transmitted at that time was. So my guess is the interference of those other services was kind of troublesome and very intermittent. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, look at it this way. They were transmitting a digital signal. It took them a while to figure out what it was, because, I mean, it just raises the noise floor if you're using the receiver. And also, you don't hear signals as well as you used to.
Okay, so it's the digital transmission broadcast. In other words, you look at it on a spectrum analyzer. It looks like a flat-top broadband noise across the 6 megacycles. As such, all of those services had X number of decibels of desensitization from their normal sensitivity. So I imagine each one of those services that used to have a range of 30 miles is suddenly down to 5 miles. Is that sort of what happened, Eric? Go ahead, K2LAW.
The people who complained the loudest were the ones with digital systems, P25, DMR, and NX, you know, various different forms. Impulse noise on top of impulse noise makes for very unhappy receivers.
You just touched on something very interesting, Eric, and that is we now know, you and I now know, that inter-symbol distortion and impulse noise on over-the-air broadcast digital television, it's reasonably vulnerable. Is DMR also vulnerable to inter-symbol distortion, impulse noise, and co-channel interference? If I want a clean DMR signal, do I have to have, let me pick a number, 17 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio? In other words, the offending signal, that'll be 17 dB weaker, otherwise my DMR crashes. Is that approximately what happens? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIWK2 again. All right, well, we're talking a different world here. You're talking about 6 megahertz versus 12.5 kilohertz. It's a different land. Yes, impulse noise bugs the heck out of it, but because the bandwidth is so much smaller, it's not as much of an issue because of this one thing. And this one thing is, every time you push the button on your transceiver, it sends a little burst to the repeater. The repeater sends back to you a timer signal as to when to transmit your 20 milliseconds. Plus, there's 4 layers of error correction that's going on here. There's Trellis, believe it or not. There's FEC. There's Reed Solomon. And there's a form of convolution encoding. So we stand a chance of multipath being less of an issue and impulse noise being less of an issue in terms of transmitting voice data, which is actually happening at 3,800 bits per second, which is really slow. So we have a lot more tolerance than we do in digital television. So what the carrier-to-noise ratio is, I don't know for sure, but I'm going to look it up just for the heck of it.
Good information. Thank you, Eric. What we need is more complication to these systems. I mean, these radio systems are getting so simple. Well, we've got to add some extra little horns and whistles to these things, Eric. Ain't easy to keep up with it all. I can tell that the Weimark people would like to be very progressive and they're diving pretty deeply into DMR. I think there are some other repeater groups saying, I'm going to sit back and watch. I don't know if I want to get involved yet. I want to see how it all turns out. And of the people who are now buying and using DMR radios, I guarantee there's a number of people within the sound of my voice right now that are not quite sure what it is, why it is, and what the advantage is. So if a person was pretty naive, like me, and said, hey, Eric, what do I gain if I invest all this extra money and all this extra programming and I do DMR? What do I get that I didn't get before? What do I get for my money? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. You know, there's a number of different answers to this. Depends upon who you know and what you're interested in. There's a number of, in ham radio, there's a number of different forms of digital transmission for voice. Okay? We've got something called DMR, which stands for Digital Mobile Radio. We've got something that was invented by the Japan Amateur Radio League, which is called Vista. We got something from Yaesu. They call it, I forget what they call it, they call it something. And they're all actually similar to one another, except the differences are within the protocol in terms of the streams that they send. The actual RF transmission methods are very similar to one another. G25, DMR, Yaesu, and the JARL is all based on what we're calling C4FM, for lack of an easier, you know, for, rather than the more complicated explanation of what it is. It's basically QPSK, which has TRELLIS inserted to it. And if you want to figure out what that is, look it up. It's pretty simple. After that, there's this method of decoding, and P25 is different from DMR, which is different from Yaesu, which is different from Vista. The way they take the data and turn it into voice, they all basically use the same codec, except some are slower than others, some are faster. The faster ones sound better. One of them has an older version of the same thing, and that one doesn't sound as nice as the newer version of the same thing. But the DMR speeds are slower, whereas the Yaesu speeds are faster, and the P25 speeds are faster, so they sound better. Let me let it drop. There's a deaf person talking here, so I'm very picky about what I can understand. The method of what they do to the audio, they send it into this device called a vocoder, which in essence, in my world, we call it a codec. What it does is it takes that audio, samples it, and then decides what to throw away and what to keep. You increase the sample rate or the speed in which you're doing it, you get a little more resolution and you wind up with better frequency response. At the slower speeds, you have to make a decision. What in speech is important and what isn't? Don't transmit what's not important, and you can do bit reduction. On HF, there is also a couple of digital formats out there. One's called Digital Voice. Actually, it uses a more open source kind of codec, which is really an MP4 if you break it down, but you can do very, very, very slow streams. You could really only allow 300 baud on HF. And by doing multiple symbols, you can beat that. So there you go. There's a lot of technology there. There's a lot of good stuff you can do with it. Unfortunately, you need a little bit of calculus in order to make some of it happen on your own. Otherwise, you've got to buy it from someone else. K2RW, K2J.
Eric, you've just given us a lot of very good information about a little bit about how it works, what it's called. But now if I zoom back, and I'm a turnkey person, I'm a appliance operator, I don't want to know about the details. I know that some of my progressive friends are spending a few hundred dollars buying these new DMR radios. Other than a kind of exclusivity, we go now to a DMR repeater, and the DMR people talk to each other, so we got a degree of exclusivity. Other than that, to an appliance operator, what do I get for my money? What's different from an appliance operator's point of view? I don't want to know anything about what's behind the front panel. K2EJ, K2RIW, the tech man, with a crazy question.
Okay, here's what's different. You don't hear squelch noise. You don't hear white noise. You hear a voice that just comes out of the air nice and clean, and then it goes away. For most people, it's even better than the telephone. Although some phones sound better than DMR, but actually a lot of phones sound better than DMR. But then again, that's a deaf person talking. So it's a different world. The other thing that you experience in analog is that, you know, people begin to get noisy before they finally dissolve into the noise. With DMR, there's this little cliff that you go over, and there's a little tiny edge of this cliff where you start getting what we call packet loss, and the speech then starts to become garbled for a very short period of time, and then it's just gone. So it's a different world in that respect. A lot of people really like it. And there's other pluses to DMR specifically, and Yaesu and the JARL Vista also has it. And that is the simultaneous data where the Yaesu, they like to do something that's like GPS, where actually their radios have the GPS in there, and on the display it will tell you exactly how far you are from the other station, even though you're going through a repeater. Little nice things like that. DMR, whomever is talking, their ID shows up in your radio. If you've got a radio that displays the ID, it's sort of like caller ID. D-Star has something similar, and P25 also. There are facilities in DMR which we amateurs are not allowed to use because they deal with encryption. There's also another important thing as far as
repeater timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because we are not allowed to do any kind of hidden communication that has to be publicly available. It's RW, K2J.
Sounds kind of good. Some of the digitized audio techniques of Motorola in the past, particularly encryption ones, have pretty yucky sounding audio. You make it sound like the DMR has the ability to be almost high fidelity. And I guess that alone will appeal to some people.
High fidelity, it's far from it.
Okay, yeah. Describe the fidelity. In other words, you were comparing it to a telephone. A modern-day telephone has got about 5 kc of instantaneous bandwidth to it. It can almost sound as good as the person is in the same room with you. I think you're to compare it to telephone may be a little bit optimistic. Go ahead, Eric. So try to describe your level of fidelity of DMR versus a modern-day telephone. Go ahead.
Again, really hard of hearing to a person talking, so it's not fair that I actually give you what we should do to get Bernie, if he's listening, who's got good ears, and let him give you that description. But what I will tell you is that the important parts of speech, the things that are sibilant, the non-vocal cords, the non-voiced part of speech, it has issues with. My hearing works purely on harmonics, where in the area that I do hear, I hear the effects of the harmonics at higher frequencies that I don't hear. But the DMR is missing for me, so it's not fair for me to give you a response. Whereas that if they were running it at 9600 baud, then I would probably say it sounds great. Because it probably would sound, it actually does sound great, that particular codec, when you run it that fast. Well, the stuff that I find missing is actually not missing at the higher rate. But let me pass it over to Bernie if he's out there and let him give you an honest description of what it sounds like. K2RW, K2EJ, and you pass it to K2IO if he's there.
K2IO, Bernie, are you there? K2RW? We're not anywhere near as late as we usually are during this portion. I know you had a series of questions. Why don't you ask them, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Can I ask one question related to my question from before?
Yeah, sorry about that, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Since there are apparently analog stations still transmitting in the United States, what designator do they use on the FCC's website looking up TV stations per RF channel?
You got it, Eric.
Go to FCC.gov/MB, the Media Bureau, and then you will find on the left side a thing called video, including television. Do a TV query and just put in channel 2 and it'll spit out every channel 2 in the country and you can find out which one is analog.
Boy, that sounds like a fun project. Let us know what you find on that one, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
I found that website when it has a TV query, FM radio queries upward. What is it designated that they use? Because they typically use DT for digital television. I haven't seen anything that looks that much different from that. What is analog? What do you know what the designator is?
Analog's a dash TV, not DT.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't know if it was before your time, Eric, but there used to be a yearly manual published by the Worldwide Television FM and DX Association, the Spiral Ring Notebook, analog television number. You go to page number 5, so to speak. You look at
they still sell that if you want to shell out the $1,000.
Are you telling me this amateur group, at least I thought they were an amateur group, Worldwide Television FM and DX Association, I'm not talking now about the...
a commercial organization that publishes it.
And it's $1,000. This used to be a $10 manual published by what I think was an amateur group back in the day. And you go to the right page, and it shows you a map of the United States, and each one of the Channel 5 television transmitters, there'd be a dot on the page with the call letters alongside of it. The opposing page would have each of the call letters listed alphabetically, and they would tell you height above average terrain, average transmitting power, what association as far as networks are concerned, and so on. A lot of darn good information. So that, and they would tell you whether or not it's a plus, minus, or a zero offset. So in other words, if you're watching digital, if you're watching television DX in those days, and you knew the offset, you knew the approximate direction you're aiming your antenna, with that manual, you could very easily find out, oh, that's a station in Chicago. So you're saying that that $10 manual has now been picked up by a commercial organization, and it's a $1,000 manual? Give me some words on that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, well, that manual, it's not a manual, it's actually it's a commercial thing. It's really for market survey research and things of that nature, where each page has the station, the map of where it is, it's grade A, it's grade B, it's population, it's rating in terms of market, etc., so on and so forth. So you can see that that, from a commercial point of view, is a very important piece of information to some people.
If I was applying for a license, I'd have to know my circle of intended coverage, whether or not it overlaps the adjacent coverages of the...
You paid a lot of money to your engineering firm and lawyer to do Langley Rice and figure all that out for you.
Yeah, but to begin the process, I mean, if there happened to be a station on that exact frequency, 40 miles away, I know I wouldn't stand a chance. I wouldn't even bother making the
application. Stand a chance.
Yeah, I wouldn't even make the application. But by way of that map, if I find out the nearest station is 500 miles away, I know I stand a chance. Now I'm willing to spend the money for the survey organization to do the Langley Rice study for me. So to begin the study, that map could be very handy. But for the television DXers like Joe, that book could be very handy to help him pin down what he's watching when he hasn't yet seen the identification. Open you for any words on this one, Eric. So is it the same organization or a new organization?
White.
Who is that?
You're getting stepped on all over the place. And
okay. You told me I'm getting stepped on all over the place.
Oh, you're not.
You haven't told me who you are. Was that NY2HF?
Affirmative, Dick. You've had people cutting in all across your conversation, so a lot of it was not audible.
Well, you're listening through the, let me see.
He's listening to 375. I don't know what's going on out there.
Yeah, I'm going to take a quick listen to 375 right now. And so, my guess is some of 375 wasn't coming through. I'm listening to what's coming back out of 85. Sorry about that, Dennis. Dennis, is there something you wanted to say to us? NY2HF, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
Just stepping all over you. No, Dick. All I wanted to say was that you were being stepped on. But I guess if I have the floor, I have a question for you. What is the most important thing in all the years that ham radio that you feel has been a attribute, you know, and has contributed to the ham radio? I know you've done a lot, but what is the one thing that stands out that you really feel proud about? Y2HF back to net.
You ain't gonna like the answer. The thing that gives me the most amount of pleasure, which is not quite the question you asked, is that radio tower. Something I can brag about. It's something I can climb. I can take a look around. tool by which I can hang antennas from it and really test the capability of an antenna. And you put an antenna on a nice high tower, and you tell your friends in various locations, give me a dead carrier for the next 2 minutes while I swing the antenna and run a strip shot recorder. And now you measure. You get a very accurate pattern of the antenna. And because you're doing it with guys in different directions, even though you're sometimes getting a reflection off the water tower, well, the reflection off the water tower is different from the guys that are in different directions or location. But to answer your question more directly, let me drop it. The answer is very different depending on the listener. For the people who are interested in space, a 12-foot stress parabolic dish, article August 1972, QST, and the June issue of 1972, Houston, this is Apollo. The equipment set up to listen to the Apollo astronauts, Apollo 15 and 16 directly. The space-oriented people think that is significant. So the guys who are on high-power transmitters, the strip-line parallel kilowatt amplifier, April and May 1972 QST, that amplifier, they thought was a significant breakthrough, particularly when they hear the story about the fact that when I submitted that article to Ham Radio Magazine, Skip Kenny, it wasn't Skip Kenny, I'm trying to think of the name of the guy who is the main publisher of the magazine, the main author. He thought it was a nut paper. In other words, putting tubes in parallel at a UHF frequency, not running them push-pull. He thought it was beyond the laws of physics. He thought it was a nut paper. He turned down the article. QST picked it up and then published it as a so-called QST extra. In other words, they thought it was a breakthrough. And every year after that, he mailed me a letter saying, please forgive us. Please send us another article. We made a mistake on that one. Let me drop. When I'm at the Rome Air Development Center, where I spent half a year there doing some antenna testing on two separate locations in near Utica, New York, and I'm looking at the world's best outdoor antenna range set up by the Air Force, where they take full-size airplanes, put them on a pedestal 35 feet high with a huge positioner on top. The airplane is mounted upside down. You put the real antennas on that airplane, and a mountain a mile and a half away, or is it 2 miles away, has another set of real fancy antennas. And between these two mountains, with a valley in between, you transmit signals and you really measure the antenna patterns on that antenna range, the world's best antenna range. I was the guy that negotiated with the Navy to do that same testing on the EA-6B airplane, because the Navy didn't have an antenna range that good. They thought the Pax River range was going to be a real good one. And somebody put a chain link fence in the wrong place and didn't have authorization to do it. So the Navy had to go hat in hand with me helping them, so to speak, go to the Air Force saying, please help us. We want to make a real good measurement of our EA-6B standoff jamming airplane. And that took place at an Air Force facility. That Air Force facility at Rome Air Development Center, to make real accurate antenna measurements, does it by antenna ratiometry. Antenna ratiometry is an IEEE article I published in 1974, I think it was. And when I was talking to the guys at the Rome Air Development Center saying that, gee, this is a very fancy arrangement you got here, this ratiometry antenna range to give you high accuracy. Where did that come from? And their answer was, yeah, the guy who used to work here, we don't know where he got it from, but he told us to do this, and we were very happy we did. And he's now retired. I didn't tell them where I thought it came from. So some people think when it comes to antenna testing, that was a breakthrough idea.
Repeater, timeout.
So if you're talking about antenna testing people, you get one answer. You talk about transmitter testing people, high-power transmitter building people, you get another answer. You talk to people who are interested in space, you get another answer. And I'm now coming up with a new antenna, if I ever get a chance to finish it. This is going to sound crazy, I'm trying to take the right vitamins, eat the right food, get enough sleep, stay healthy, because I'm a little bit worried that the next project, it's a really fancy rock crusher of an antenna, I'm worried that I might not live long enough to finish that particular project. Of course, that's a crazy goal. But one way of looking at it, Dennis, is that a crazy goal is better than no goal. I know you didn't get a direct answer, but that's what I can think of right off the top of my head. NY2HF, T2RIW in the TechNet, crazy question.
NY2HF. Well, you know, you guys got a parallel universe, you and Jay, NY2NY, because he's about to give a thing at the Custer Institute and Observatory. We're going to announce the radio signals off meteors or the moon or whatever else, and he's really good at it, and I know you two guys were roommates. Guys, both of you are brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Now, keep up doing what you're doing, because it's really good, and it informs a lot of people who are listening, NY2HF.
If I keep sending you checks, will you keep saying that, Dennis? Thank you. It turns out that Jay and I, yes, we were both roommates in our senior year of college, Electrical Engineering College, Pratt Institute, way back in the dark ages of 1964. And his first house after he got married was in St. James. And my house, my first rental house was in Smithtown. So we were, I don't know the exact number, 8-10 miles apart. One of the interesting experiments Jay and I ran into, this was 1968. We were both getting on the 432 megacycle band, which was considered the super high frequency for ham radio in those days. And we ran an experiment where I borrowed a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator from Airborne Instruments Laboratory, brought it home for a weekend, transmitted into a wire dipole that was, 12 inches long, taped to the wall of the sheetrock rental house in Smithtown, and by adjusting the signal generator weaker and weaker to find out how weaker signal we could transmit, I got down to, minus 40 dBm. Yes, I think it was minus 40 dBm out of the signal generator. He could still hear the signal with his Yagi antenna on the roof of his house, 8 or so miles away, and I was transmitting slow speed. I was transmitting slow speed code to him by plugging the BNC connector in and out of the signal generator. So when it comes to QRP, of course I didn't come anywhere near what you would. Let me double check. Yeah, I'm double checking that the signal is coming through on the other side. Let me drop. Minus 40 dBm signal, roughly 8 miles. And miles per watt, that was a real good QRP guess. But when you compare that to Voyager, 12 billion miles away, and Voyager, 12 billion miles away, is transmitting 6 watts of signal that NASA can receive. Oh boy, I did a calculation last night. If Voyager was mounted on the moon instead of where it is, which would be 50,000 times closer, 94 dB stronger signal because of inverse square law. How low a signal could the Voyager transmit from the moon and NASA still be able to hear it? And the number sounds crazy. It's 2.5 nanowatts. A billionth of a watt. They could be transmitting a billionth of a watt and you'd still be getting it. NY2HF for any other comments? K2RIW and TechNet. Go ahead, Dennis.
Have you heard anything about the radio bursts that have been going on? The radio bursts that have come in, and the 5 more that are going to be published in the paper, but the radio bursts that come from all parts of the, universe, in every direction, and so far it's unexplainable. Heard anything about that?
You might be referring to gamma ray bursts for 20 or so years. Anybody who's got the right kind of a radio telescope in all directions in space, very, very rare circumstances, and maybe it's once or twice per month, you get this extremely strong burst. They call it a gamma ray burst, and they haven't yet figured out what it was. So that might be one of the things you're referring to. And I do remember some of the radio astronomers that I met at the Green Bank Radio Telescope when I was there for a Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, SARA, meeting a decade ago. Those guys were asking me, I was giving a speech on the subject of antenna design, and they said, could you give me a high-gain antenna that can listen to all directions at once. And it turns out that's beyond the laws of physics. And they were studying gamma ray bursts at that time. They wanted to find out where it's coming from. And so that may be what you're referring to. I'm not sure. There are other kinds of things going on where every so often the alpha magnetic spectrometer is measuring things like positrons. It's measuring these great big bursts of opposite polarity energy coming in periodically that saturates whatever detector they've got. So what Mother Nature is doing out there at long distances ain't easy to figure out. So you think it might have been gamma ray bursts you're referring to? NY2 HF, wait for the beam, K2RIW, the tech man.
Actually, Dick, the source that I was listening to was saying that, you know, it might be something other than a gamma burst. What happened was they got 11 hits on a radio burst and trained all the antennas, radio antennas, where they thought it was coming from. But it was coming from all over the place and, at different intervals. So it was coming from different distances. And at first they thought that maybe it was just a reflection off the ionosphere or magnetosphere, but that's not what was occurring. And now there were five more that they recorded, but there's a paper coming out, but it hasn't come out yet. So, you know, I'm not sure if this is actually gamma burst or literal radio, burst, where it's not gamma, it's actually something that's going on beyond that. Like I said, I don't know, but, there's larger minds beyond mine that trying to figure it out, but very interesting to try to follow. Back to you, Dick, NY2HF.
Yeah, as we do more and more research on space, we're finding out that the universe is stranger than you can think of, stranger than science fiction. Mother Nature has got a lot of surprises for us. This universe was not invented for us, for it to be easy for us to understand. And it's a fascinating thing. You get some very mixed opinions on people saying that, $8 billion or $18 billion a year we spend with NASA, we should spend that on the people who are starving to death. Well, it's a half a cent on the dollar is one way of looking at it. Every man, woman, and child is spending, a dollar and a half a month for NASA. I'm convinced we're getting our money's worth, but not everyone will agree with that. You listen to a lecture by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he's saying that we should double the budget we give to NASA because we're getting a lot of bang for the money out of it. What Hubble has done, for instance, the Hubble Space Telescope, is reciting the daylights out of people. And when the new infrared telescope is put up in 2018, why can't I think of the name of the darn thing? John, what's the name of that telescope?
James Webb.
That's the one, the James Webb telescope. You just wait and see what it's going to measure. You have reason to believe that the James Webb telescope is going to allow us to directly view the individual planets that are Earth-like that are going around other stars. And so right now, 10% of all the stars are believed to have Earth-like planets. I used to think planets going around a star was a once-in-a-million rare event. We're suddenly discovering that 10% of them, almost all of them have planets, and 10% of them have Earth-like planets, and a good number of those are in the Goldilocks zone. So there's a lot of possibilities out there for life. Let me make sure that, yeah, that's still coming through. We'll come to the going to be able to hear it on 375. So you ain't heard nothing yet. Just wait till some of those future spacecraft are launched. Eric, I know that you had a question you wanted to ask, Eric. Why don't you put it in right now? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe Eric's not available. John, time to go to the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go easy with us, John. I know that some of these guys ask questions that are pretty tough. That lady who asked us the question about the weight of a of an electron signal. We haven't heard the end of that one yet. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Yes. I want to let things reset. You hear me all right, Dick?
Loud and clear.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. All right. First thing, we have this gentleman, relatively new ham, AD2XP, name is John Barry, posted a question, he would like to know, where can he find assistance in getting some antennas put up, whether, how would he get a hold of hams, or how could he get somebody, especially if there's anybody who could help this gentleman. Unfortunately, he did not give me an email, but he may have it listed on QRZ, but he'd like some help with some antenna erection.
Yeah, I just looked him up on QRZ.com, and I looked him up on the map. He's in a town called Painted Post, New York. The nearest thing that I can recognize is Elmira, New York. And so when I was working at the Romare Development Center near, it wasn't near Elmira, but it was at least in that section of New York State near the Finger Lakes. There's a good number of pretty progressive hams up there, particularly the Rochester group. The Rochester Amateur Radio Association, RARA. That's in his backyard. A very progressive group that prints a monthly journal. If he just gets on the distribution of the Rochester Amateur Radio Association and starts attending those meetings and starts becoming friendly with those guys, guaranteed there's a group there that's half as populated as the Limot group is down here on Long Island. So that's a possible suggestion. That's a very progressive group. The Rochester group has been doing a lot of very good VHF, HF work for 30 years that I know about, John. So that's a good beginning. You gotta get familiar with the local guys in your neighborhood in order to get that kind of assistance. On top of that, let me drop this.
Don't they have a website, Dick?
They would absolutely have to. So if you simply Google the word Rochester Amateur Radio Association, I'm pretty sure you'll find their website. And the easiest way to get a hold of their journal, but now that you know the name of an organization that's very active in Rochester, New York area, which from my point of view is not that far away from Elmira, for people who really live there, but of course it's down the road a piece, but to me, I group together upper New York State to roll in each other's backyard from my point of view, which of course is very provincial. So that's the best suggestion I can think of. Drag your feet in case anyone else has any other suggestions for KD2XP. His name is Harold. KC2WGB to take it with some delay. K2IW in the TechNet.
NY2HF would a comment.
Go right ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. Ham clubs, organizations, and gonna erect antennas. Just make sure that the person who wants it all erected, you know, is gonna supply the beverages and food, and you know, people will come by and they'll chip in. You know, if somebody really needs it, they're gonna do it. So that's my suggestion. Or whatever else, and get the people around. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I was copying Dennis continuously through the 975-375 repeater, and so little portions of that didn't come through because of the local going on. Turns out that the local groups really do help. The saddest situation I know of is a man I know who lived near Buffalo, a ham who was a little bit, he's a silent key now, so I can say these things that are a little bit derogatory sounding, but truthful. He was a little bit paranoid about, although he owned 6 acres of property, he was afraid that his neighbors were going to give him some trouble, so he tried to keep his operation as low-key as possible. As such, he didn't even become familiar with his local ham radio operators. He needed a lot of help in order to install this 28-foot dish, which he had purchased from me. I had this 28-foot dish that I was no longer using. I sold it to him. He moved it to Buffalo, and now he wanted to set it up, and he needed some help to move the pedestal in the right place, to take this 2,500-pound antenna, put it in the right place. He needed help from the local hams, and because he had kept himself so quiet and low-key, he hadn't formed any local friendships, and therefore that whole operation became very difficult for him. And so 5 years later, it didn't yet become operational, and he became a silent key, and another amateur in the Rochester area purchased that antenna from him. So we amateurs are very good. It's a fraternity. We're very good at supporting each other's operation. But you got to get on the local repeaters, 2 meters, 440 repeaters. It's the easiest way to find your local people and to become familiar with them, for them to like your operation and want to help you. And so, as Dennis was saying, there are times where once you form the right friendships, all you got to do is supply Coca-Cola and pizza, and you can get a lot of manpower to install towers and antennas and whatever. Let me drop one other point I want to make.
Say word.
You all have a fear of height. I'm one of those people. Whenever I do any serious work on my tower where I spend more than a half hour or so above the 60-foot level, I spend the next night having nightmares of falling off a tower. The biggest thing you got to do is have the right safety equipment. If you've got the right kind of a harness with two separate lanyards that go around the tower, so you've got redundancy, so that when you're on station, you're attached twice, and as you climb past the guy wires, connect the upper lanyard while you disconnect the lower lanyard while you're going past the set of guy wires when you're climbing your tower. So to install your antennas on the tower the first time, to get your local hams to help you do that, that's great. But if you're going to be really serious, you're going to be changing antennas from time to time, repairing antennas, putting new frequencies on it. You're going to be climbing your tower once every couple of weeks. You're not going to get your friends to volunteer that often. Some of it's going to have to eventually be of your own resources, if you know what I mean. Or, if you've got a whole lot of money and you can hire a rigger, once in a blue moon you'll find somebody that'll volunteer that for you. But under normal circumstances, once you own a tower, if you're really using it, you're going to want to change something on it at least once every month, is my opinion. KC2WGB, K2RIW, John, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, very true. And that issue about height, normal people they have some difficulty with height. As I've climbed, I've been extremely high, and it does happen to all of us. And when you're away from the job for a few months and you go back up and do some high walking, you do have some trepidation. But, you know, as long as you're using the right safety equipment, healthy, do get used to it, and you can do it without any problem at all. Okay, well, I hope John finds somebody up there. There should be plenty of people in that area. There's quite a few hams, so he'll probably get some benefit. I know he's been listening for a long time to the TechNet, and this is the first email I've ever received from him, so I wish him luck with that. Let me let it drop. I'm going to go on to the next station to WGB.
His name is Harold. Harold A. Brownson. Harold A. B-R-O-U-N. I can't see it. But I think Harold will eventually find a solution to that. But getting friendly with the local hams is the best way to go. Go ahead, John.
His call sign is Kilo Delta 2. X-ray Papa. Maybe you misunderstood that. Maybe I gave you the wrong call sign. And he's listed on chat room as John Barry, but be assuming.
If you take a look at QRZ.com, you're going to find Kilo Delta 2 X-ray Popper. It's Harold A. Brownus, B-R-O-U-N-E-U-S, Painted Post, New York. And that's near Elmira. That's Kilo Delta 2 X-ray Popper. According to QRZ.com. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Oh, I'm not doubting you, Dick. You just, it shocked me. That's the name he listed, but that call sign, and he knows either way, he'll know who he is. Very good. They're dropping one. This next one. Okay, we have an amateur here who chimed in on a discussion we had last week about bird watt meters, and he wants to know, maybe he's wrong, but does not see problem with using a 10-watt slug to measure a 100-watt amplifier in the mode trying to find, you know, the 1 or 2-watt returning power. Claim is, let me let it drop.
But he's not.
His claim is that when he takes apart the slugs, that terminating resistor is basically the same size slugs. So I'm wondering, value has to be exactly the same. If the wattage or the power capability increased, it would have to have a larger size. So he's went on, and he'd like you to give some more info on that. Maybe there's a way you can check it out. He's saying maybe they use the heaviest one to work in all of them. Don't know.
Let me pick numbers out of the air, John. Let's assume that it takes 5 milliwatts of power to move that Dawson valve movement all the way over to the right on your bird watt meter. So your slug has to pick up power, rectify that power to a DC voltage, which becomes a current in that meter, and then something like a 30 or a 50 microampere meter requires, in my crazy guess, 5 milliwatts of power to do that. Therefore, in all cases, the slug has to supply that many milliwatts to move the meter. In some cases, the slug has to be made very sensitive because you want the slug to be 10 watts full scale. In another case, you want the slug to be very insensitive because you want the slug to be 5 kilowatts full scale. So what changes on that slug to give it high sensitivity to be able to detect a low amount of power, low sensitivity to detect a high amount of power? What's your guess as to what changes in the slug itself to adjust what's the maximum power it can tolerate, or what it's calibrated for? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, it could be the coupling coefficient.
Give that man a cigar. You got it, John. The way a directional coupler works is that it's got a parallel line alongside of the main straight-through line. How close your parallel line is determines what percentage of the power is sampled. A 10-watt full-scale or a 1-watt full-scale slug, the coupling loop inside is placed very close to that center conducting line. By comparison, a 5-kilowatt, or I think Eric told us he's even got a 50-kilowatt job, the coupling loop is very far away. You only want to see, by inverse square law, as the coupling loop that's inside of the slug is moved further and further away, it samples less and less power. So therefore, in all cases, the amount of power that the slug sees and rectifies is almost the same in all cases. So the slug itself, because of its distance from that straight-through line, picks up a different amount of power. So now, if I've got a 1,500-watt power transmitter, and I measure what I think is 15 watts forward and something like 3 watts coming back, but because the 3 watts on the 1500 watt scale is way down at the bottom, I can't read it accurately. Let me drop this. It's very tempting to pick up the 5 watt slug in order to measure that reverse power. Okay. Every directional coupler in that slug is a dual directional coupler. You happen to only be rectifying the forward going or the reverse power. drift in that direction. But in all cases, the power in the other direction has to be dissipated by that internal resistor. Every directional coupler is a dual directional coupler. The directional power that you don't care about is going into a terminating resistor. So therefore, if I've got 1500 watts going forward, and I'm using the 1500 watt slug, I'm picking up the 5 milliwatts of power forward, and if there was 1500 watts flowing in the wrong direction, the 5 milliwatts would be at the terminating resistor. If I now pick up the 10 watt slug, when there's really 1500 watts there, therefore that slug has got a directional coupler that's very close to the straight through line, I'm now picking up watts of power instead of milliwatts of power by that directional coupler. And even though I'm in the reverse direction and I'm only looking at the 5 watts reverse, the 1500 watts forward and the proportion of it that slug picks up has to be dissipated by that resistor. You will burn up that resistor. Now, you can push your luck a little bit. By that I mean, if you're using the 1500 watt slug to measure forward and you're using a 150 watt slug to measure reverse, I think you'll get away with it. You go down to a 10 dB difference, I think you'll get away with it. A 20 dB difference, 100-to-1 ratio, I'm pretty sure you're going to damage the slug because you're picking up too much power by the so-called low-power slug because it's got a coupler that's so closely spaced. You had the right concept, and now once you see that every directional coupler is a dual-directional coupler, the power in the direction you don't care about has to go somewhere. It's going into that internal terminating resistor. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. That explains it for him. Now he can realize they use the exact same resistor in all of them. It's the spacing of that coupling that is causing the problem when you use it the wrong way. Perfect. I'm sure he understands that now. Better drop lock one for the next one. Hey, Dick. Dick, last week we left off explaining the square law meter and that 415E. Although the one that was in question is 415E, you were going to give them some tips on using that and what it's used for. So maybe you can give them a little bit on that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
There are a large number of outdoor antenna ranges that use that Hewlett-Packard 415, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, X-ray. There's a whole lot of dash numbers. The early versions of the Hewlett-Packard 415 is kind of homely looking. The later versions are a much fancier looking front panel. But the electronics inside, in all cases, is fairly similar. And what makes that such an attractive meter for doing outdoor antenna range testing is that it has a huge dynamic range. It's got a click, click, click rotary dial on the front panel.
Yeah, 60 dB attenuation with 10 dB per function.
I think you're saying, John, that the total dynamic range between the highest range and the lowest range is about 6 clicks of 10 dB each, 60 decibels of dynamic range on that rotary.
That's correct.
And that in itself makes it a very valuable instrument. Common sense would lead you to believe that you've got an antenna on the test, you've got a transmitter on this antenna range 100 feet away transmitting a signal, and the antenna on the test you're using as a receiving antenna, and whatever power it receives, you can put it into a power meter, a watt meter. Good sounding common sense. Two things wrong with it. You go through the calculation of a range that's long enough and the amount of power you're transmitting, you've either got to transmit a hell of a lot of power, or the other problem is that what you're going to receive is a small number of milliwatts, and maybe your power meter is not going to give you enough dynamic range to see the side lobes and the back lobes. So getting enough dynamic range and enough sensitivity on an antenna range is a little bit of a problem. You'd like it to be a low-power transmitter, so you're not burning up the world and using up final stages while you're running this thing.